This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. Talk with Dr. Martin Clemis, our Vietnam expert. So, Dr. Clemis, welcome.
Oh, great being here. Thank you.
And today we're going to talk about a very important part of Vietnam, which is the philosophy or perhaps theory of Dao Tran, which I think a lot of people have identified as being kind of the driving philosophy of the communist victory in the war. So, let's start kind of very general, Dr. Clemis. We tend to view Vietnam as being a conflict that took place between 1964, 1965, and 1973 and 1975. How do the Vietnamese, particularly the Vietnamese communists, look at the war?
Okay. Well, they look at the American war as very distinct from the French war, and they when they look at the American involvement, they look at it at different phases. They had something at first that they called special war, and that was just when the United States was merely advising the South Vietnamese government, providing them with arms and advisors to try to get them to be able to defend their country on their own.
So this is like 60 to 63, 4 maybe?
Actually, even before that. Okay. As soon as after Geneva, 1955, Ngo Dinh Diem declares himself president of a independent Republic of South Vietnam, or Republic of Vietnam, South Vietnam as we called it, a non-communist state. We immediately start giving them aid. And it's really in that period when they start describing this as a special war.
Okay.
Once American combat troops get involved directly, that transitions over to something they call now a limited war, in which their objective then is to focus on the Americans, get the Americans out so that they can refocus back on the South Vietnamese and topple that government as well. And then their third conception, which never went there, was something they called general war, in which they believed if it escalated and brought in directly other outside powers such as China or the Soviet Union in this conflict. So for them, the practical aspects or the actual implemented aspects were only that special war and limited war aspects. But this Dao Tran strategy was found throughout both of those.
So as you mentioned, the goal here is the reunification of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And the implementation, I presume, of a communist government.
Yes.
So you have there kind of a military strategic goal and then a political philosophical goal.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. And they mesh the two, and that's the kind of unique aspect and the winning aspect of this Dao Tran strategy. The Vietnamese communists, I think, understood the true nature of war much better than the Americans, and the fact that they synthesized military and political effort and created kind of a synergy of effects, which eventually will allow them to defeat a much larger, more powerful, more diplomatically experienced, warfighting experienced superpower. Mm-hmm. Using this particular strategy.
Okay, and let's kind of get a baseline. Dr. Nance, you've participated in campaigns doing this. So how does America look at conflicts, both in the military strategic side and the political philosophical side?
And this is, of course, the problem, right, is that what we teach and what our theory goes is that there is a military goal which will achieve a political goal. This is Clausewitz 101.
Right.
What you see particularly in cases like Iraq and Afghanistan, and this is actually a connective piece of tissue back to Vietnam, is we don't exactly know how to achieve our political goal with military means. Who do we kill? What do we blow up? What do we capture? So what we end up with is we have military objectives, which is I'm going to go after Zarqawi is a common name from my era. But The idea being is that we're going to go after all these individual goals, and hopefully that will somehow translate into a political objective.
That's the Napoleonic victory.
Right. And you see this quite a bit if you look at American military history. We do this quite a bit, which is the military success obviates the need to actually be very nuanced in the diplomatic realm. If you look at the Civil War, you look at World War I. World War I is an interesting case study, but the popularly held American view of World War One, right. World War II, you look at those wars in particular, the Native Wars, all throughout mm-hmm. our history. Military success obviated the need to be nuanced politically, and because of that, that's led to perhaps less focus on trying to truly mesh the political and the military together.
Okay, that's a very good explanation, and we'll circle back to that at the end. All right, Dr. Clemes, let's talk about some of the antecedents that feed into Dautron.
Okay, sure.
So I think we have kind of a line or perhaps a series of inputs, one of them from the Marxist-Leninist school and then one of them from the Maoist school.
Right.
So how does Marxism-Leninism influence the leaders of Vietnamese communism?
Okay, well, yeah, the beginnings start really, if you're going to classify what the Vietnamese strategy was and their way of waging war, it's really revolutionary war. And modern revolutionary war really starts with Mao. Yes, there are revolutions beforehand. There are certain elements as insurrection and political components of war which precede that. But it's really Mao who puts the pieces together within the context of shifting geopolitical situations and global politics. In the 20th century. And for Mao, really, Marxism-Leninism is what drives the revolution, right? These are Marxist revolutions. They are from the beginning. And as a result, it's also an effort for mass politics. It's inspired a lot by the Russian Revolution. However, for Mao, right, China is not a largely industrialized nation. So where is the proletariat in his revolution to overthrow the existing status quo and eventually bury capitalism and imperialism in its own blood? That is with the rural masses. So this is a peasant movement based upon the primacy of the party. That's the other thing. The party rules. The party commands the military, the people themselves, the peasants are the military, they are the army, this is a people's army themselves. So it's really mass politics based upon the rural context of China.
I want to pull on something you said very briefly. Yep. You talk about the revolution. So when Americans typically think revolution, they think the American Revolution, which is more properly called the American War for Independence. So what is it about there? What is it a revolution, and how is that different from, say, a war of independence or just a straight-up war? What makes revolution so central to this idea of Marxism-Leninism?
Right. It's the idea that you are going to completely overturn the existing social, economic, political order and build a brand new regime or society, if you will, on the ashes of that, based upon social justice and equity and all these things that are kind of boilerplate for Marxist vision, a classless society. So this is what it was intended to do. Yes, China was never formally colonized. It was semi-colonial, as Mao himself described the country. However, it had been pushed around for a very long time by Western powers through unequal economic treaties, and it was looking to reverse that course. For people like Mao or Ho Chi Minh and the Vietnamese communists, Marxism and Leninism really offered a blueprint for national independence and kind of freedom in the modern world for states and peoples that had been kind of marginalized in the mm-hmm. period and oppressed, right, and exploited during the periods of European imperialism. So this is an effort to overdo that. So for Mao, it's a complete revolution to bring in a Marxist revolution, fundamentally transform Chinese society to make it a communist state. And for him, insurrection and revolution, and particularly revolutionary violence, right, is the way to achieve this. I mean, that's what Lenin, he brings to the mixture of why we have not only Marx's ideas, but now Leninism. Leninism is the idea that you have a vanguard party who is going to marshal the people, right, create a fist out of the people, and through violence and force overthrow the bourgeois or the existing regime and bring in the dictator or the proletariat and all that other stuff that they talk about.
So then with Mao, so we have Marxism-Leninism, but Dr. Abel mentioned there's also Maoism.
Yes.
But you could argue that communism is communism, but Maoism and Marxism-Leninism are different. So can you kind of highlight the difference there?
I think the difference really is Maoism is just within an agrarian context, right? Mm-hmm. It's the same kind of principles, but it's in peoples and societies who had a different relation or different kind of history than in industrialized Europe.
And a lot of this was Marx and Engels were operating in industrialized Western Europe, right? So mm-hmm. Engels writes lots about how to build a barricade in a city street, right?
Yes, yeah.
And I think, if I remember correctly, Mao said they basically tried this and it didn't work. So then he had to go to the peasants.
There was a disagreement among the Chinese communists themselves. And Mao eventually, of course, strangled any dissent or dissenting views out of those individuals over time, but yeah, there was disagreement and debate, just as there was among the Bolsheviks, and how you're going to wage this kind of revolution. And after it was initially tried, I believe, and crushed pretty easily by Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists, Mao understood that the way to do this is to go to the people themselves, where the bulk of the population lives in the countryside.
So the way we teach Mao here is we talk about the agrarian nature of it. We talk about how he's talking specifically about China, which is important. But we also talk about this kind of the practical side of it, how he has these kind of three phases.
Yes.
So could you walk us through those briefly?
Sure, absolutely. Another key element of Maoism, and this is the thing when we think about Mao, Mao didn't kind of sit down and think about these things and put them all together as a kind of comprehensive theory of war. He develops them in an ad hoc fashion over time, over decades. The 20s and 30s and 40s, China is engaging with two major, the Chinese Communist Party is engaging with two primary adversaries, Chiang Kai-shek and the Nationalist Party in China, and then also the Japanese during World War II and their occupation. Mm-hmm. So he does this kind of over time, but these three phases are essentially part of why you pursue guerrilla warfare or protracted warfare is because the nature of the conflict is asymmetrical. As Mao said, the Red Army is small and weak, right? Our adversary is large and strong. So you got to start someplace. So the three stages was initially you have to start someplace due to that asymmetrical disadvantage that you have. So you're going to the revolution will unfold over three phases. The first phase is that it's just really your mass political mobilization, if you will. You're trying to fight the stronger adversary, be it the Japanese or the Nationalists. You don't have many weapons. You don't have many people under your control. So that is really the stage of strategic defense. You're simply just trying to wage guerrilla warfare to live and fight another day, to gain whatever resources you can, grow your movement, reach out to the disaffected masses in the countryside and grow that movement. You have the party there, the Communist Party. This is a Leninist movement. They know that. That's what they use. They use propaganda to land reform, right, to vilify landlords and the kind of ruling class. They speak of empowering the people themselves. So the first stage is obviously very tenuous. You do very little. You wage some guerrilla warfare. You try to grow your movement, grow your guerrilla movement and the people, the kind of mass political movement from the people themselves.
So this is just like meetings at night?
No, not so much. I mean, there are targeted assassinations, and there are small kind of guerrilla attacks, sporadic attacks in the countryside, trying to gain weapons, trying to gain resources to grow that movement.
So this is political proselytization as well.
That's
kind of the heart of this whole process.
And that's the thing as well. You're not just fighting, you're also spreading a political message as well, too, and mobilizing the masses politically, trying to raise their political consciousness, convince them how crappy you got it, show them who the enemy is, and give them a blueprint for reversing your poor situation.
Basically building a political foundation upon which all else can be built.
Yes, because the army is going to come, as well as the political cadre, from the people themselves, the masses. Once that grows over a certain amount of time, you're going to reach a state of strategic equilibrium in which, through guerrilla warfare, fighting behind enemy lines, having base areas that you can hide, rest, refit, your movement's growing in the countryside, more people are siding with you, you're eventually going to be able to grind down your adversary and reach a state of equilibrium, the relative parity between your adversary and your own movement. From there, that's still pretty much marked by guerrilla warfare. But while you're doing that, and this is the whole thing, Mao understood that guerrillas can't win anything on their own. You also have to build a conventional force. Mm-hmm. You're also going to try to look for outside help during this period as well, too. You're going to look for people who might sympathize with your situation due to the kind of semi-colonial situation or imperialist or colonialism, or find outright ideological brethren, meaning fellow Marxist states.
Right.
So while you are growing your, waging guerrilla warfare, and that's expanding in size and scope and its intensity and success, you're also growing a conventional army. And once they reach kind of a certain level, you're going to reach a state of kind of equilibrium with your adversary. From there, you're going to transition up to the third phase, which is kind of the strategic offense. Once you have the military means to do so, you're going to wage this hybrid attack through guerrillas and conventional forces in a kind of coup de main and a knockout blow against your adversary. So he sees this kind of progression from, laying low, being on the defense, fighting and living to fight another day, reaching a state of equilibrium, and then going on the offense. And that's really how it played out in China. Mm-hmm. He didn't write this down before, and this is how we're going to do it. That's how it kind of played out.
Which is what Marx did, too. We tend to forget Marx is a historian. So yes. He's looking back at history and saying, this is how it worked. Therefore, this is the science of it.
Yes, and that's the other thing. Mao is steeped not only in history of China, but in military history and military theory as well. He knows Clausewitz. He knows, obviously, Jomini. He talks about encirclement and counter-encirclement and lines of effort, all that kind of stuff as well, too. So they know their history, they know their military history, and they know their military theory as well, too.
And also, where does Mao view kind of the center of gravity of this revolution? Where does he sit thinking, this is what we must do?
It's really the people, right? You mobilize the masses, your army, be it conventional or guerrilla army, that's going to be based upon the masses as well, too.
So the idea of basically being is by the time you reach that third phase, your opponent looks behind them and realizes that they're basically all by themselves because the people have risen up against them.
Essentially, when you have these kind of peasant societies and where the nationalists and the Japanese, and this goes for the French and Indochina as well, too, is that they tend to be stronger in the urban areas. You go back to even the Iberian campaign, right, and the peninsula during the Napoleonic Wars, right? The French had kind of solid control of kind of, towns and villages, kind of urban centers. But meanwhile, the guerrillas have free reign in the countryside because they're simply not strong enough to go out and eliminate this insurgent threat. So for Mao, it's eventually to surround those cities and eventually kind of suffocate them, if you will, to gradually grow your movement, grow in a quote-unquote insurgent state inside the incumbent state to eventually kind of overwhelm and strangle your adversary. Much like a cancer, how it will metastasize and grow through the body, that's how he believed his political military movement would just grow over time, eventually smother and kill its adversary.
Okay, so we have this Marxist-Leninist theory, which manifested in the Soviet Union. We have the Maoist theory that manifests in the People's Republic of China. Mm-hmm. As these theories are being tested and put into practice, what are the Vietnamese leaders doing as they're sitting under French colonial rule up until 1954?
Right. Well, both politically and militarily, they made a lot of connections in China. Ho Chi Minh himself spends decades in China working with kind of fellow Marxists, figuring out, learning the ropes of guerrilla warfare and political agitation and propagandizing and how to grow a kind of a nucleus movement, which later on you hope to grow to be a full-fledged movement as well, too. So they're aware of what's going on in China, and people like Ho Chi Minh and Lê Duẩn and others have definitely talked about the inspiration that Mao had brought and the mm-hmm. examples and the kind of blueprint that Mao provided for them. However, they always said, this is great, we're going to take those elements, but we're going to make sure that we contextualize them within the context of Vietnam, because Vietnam is not China, and our situation is a little bit different. So although they borrow elements, including a vanguard Marxist party, including a hybrid effort between conventional and guerrillas, and they initially embrace that three-stage process, they will make certain modifications themselves over time, and this is where Dao Tron and something called the General Offensive and General Uprising strategy comes in as well.
So there's an important nuance here that I think it's worth understanding. Dr. Nance kind of jokingly said, all communists are alike, but this was the serious problem that America had during the Cold War, because we actually thought all communists were alike.
Yes.
Vietnam, in some ways, is a reluctant client state of China. It's been under Chinese regional hegemony on and off for centuries.
Yes.
So if you're Vietnam, how do you balance taking Chinese money, training, supplies, equipment, even soldiers and ideas with not becoming part of China.
The other way they do that is by triangulating and looking to the Soviet Union at times. One thing that the Vietnamese communists identified early and understood in a way the United States did not during the Cold War is that there is this rift between Moscow and Beijing that we can exploit for our own benefit, and which is exactly what they did. They knew they were not monolithic. Yes, they still shared Marxist-Leninist ideals. They had fealty to that. They knew they were fellow ideological travelers. But you're correct that Vietnam has a long contentious history with China. It's often been overplayed particularly by the Vietnamese revolutionaries and people like Ho Chi Minh and others, the communists, during the war, that they were always occupied by the Chinese. And that's true. There were elements, there were four eras of domination by various dynasties in China when they came in and occupied. But many times they were invited by Vietnamese themselves who were trying to gain a leg up on their internal rivals, if you will. Because Vietnam was not a unified country. That's another myth that they told during the war against the Americans. Had been unified for a very long time. Most of Vietnam's history is one of internal civil wars and political disputations between various different groups, which evolved over time.
So let's start putting a timeline on this. So we've got, we want to go all the way back to the Treaty of Versailles, 1918, as that's a place to probably start. So when does, because Vietnam's had several uprisings against colonial powers in its history of domination by the French. We'll just keep the French to keep it more relatively bounded. So Ho Chi Minh arrives on the scene around the era of the First World War. So let's take, how does this grow from Ho Chi Minh wants Vietnamese Vietnam, and how does that grow into learning Marxism, then Maoism, into what would become Dao Tran?
Okay, right. That's a really good question. French colonialism, because it is so brutal and exploitative and oppressive, naturally bred Vietnamese nationalism. Now, Vietnamese nationalism was very complex. There was not one brand. Ho Chi Minh and the Vietnamese communists were not the only authentic brand. There were many different variations of Vietnamese nationalism. And that's part of the problem, right? Although they were developing by the late 19th century, early 20th century, a real political consciousness, right? Knowing that this situation stinks, we are Vietnamese, we are not French, we want to somehow change this system. We want to achieve independence and have our own, national autonomy and national ability to bring a modern Vietnam at our own hands. But they could never get their act together. And yes, there were occasional rebellions and uprisings against the French, but the French were easily able to crush those things, oftentimes with the help of indigenous Vietnamese or indigenous Laotians and Cambodians, right? Because that's part of the insidious nature of imperialism. It had to co-opt local elites to help them administer these kind of these colonies. So for a long time, there were rebellions and pushback. People hated the system under the French, those who weren't benefiting, which was just about everybody except the elites, a small handful of elites, but those were easily crushed. However, things start changing beginning in the mid-20th century. Now, Ho Chi Minh is part of what they call the Mandarin class. He was educated. His father was a petty official in the French colonial administration. But he comes very disillusioned. He understands there's not a lot of prospects for him. So he leaves Vietnam in 1911, and he travels abroad for about 30 years or so. One of the places he ends up is in France, and France has a strong socialist communist movement at that time. And although he doesn't fully embrace this, one of the things he does find very appealing is Lenin's tracts or screeds, call them what you will, against imperialism, right? For Lenin, imperialism was the highest form of capitalism and the last form. And if you can take that down, capitalism itself is going to collapse. Now, for people like Ho Chi Minh, who've been living under the yoke of European colonialists for so long, this was great. This was like music to their ears, the idea that getting rid of imperialism, because for Ho Chi Minh, that meant Vietnamese independence and getting the French the hell out of Indochina. So he's becoming more receptive to it.
It's worth pointing out, too, that it's hard for modern people to wrap their minds around early 20th century politics. But in France, for most of the 20th century, the left was pro-colonialist. It's this whole civilizing mission idea.
Yes.
So it's not like he could find a moderate leftist appeal to decolonize. In fact, those were the colonizers. So it makes sense that he would reach more radical.
Right, right. And yes, that's exactly. And that's one of the things I found very interesting, including with, you know, even like, you know, when studying this more in depth, the nature of Chiang Kai-shek and the Chinese nationalists as well, too, who were not necessarily a right-wing government.
Oh, yeah. They at least purported to be socialists, right?
Yeah, and they had ties with Moscow and everything as well, too. So it's interesting when you see that. But yes, in France, there's not a lot of places to go, right? Because a lot of the left-leaning governments in France were pro-colonialism, without a doubt. At the end of World War II, this is kind of like almost the straw that breaks the camel's back, if you will. Ho Chi Minh tries to seek audience with the victorious Allies. He's very inspired, first, yes, of course, by Lenin, as we just talked about, but now Woodrow Wilson's 14 points and the idea of national self-determination for all nations, he found that highly appealing.
In the First World War.
Yes. So in 1919, he goes to Paris, tries to meet with them, and they naturally snub him. Right? As we know, Wilson is just an inveterate racist. When he talked about national self-determination, he didn't mean for the peoples of Asia and Latin America and others. He's really talking about European powers. So he's essentially snubbed. And for him, this is what kind of finally pushes him into a much more harder leftward-leaning trajectory.
I'm doing air quotes, but he tried it the right way.
Right. He tries to approach it the right way. But they don't want to talk to this guy. He's a nobody, right? They're the great power, or in their eyes, they're the great powers. So this is now when he really starts embracing hard left politics. He forms the Indochina Communist Party he joins the French Socialist Party at first. He forms the Indochina Communist Party, I believe, in 1920.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, in France, even the communists don't want anything to do with essentially non-white communists. Well, they're just not interested.
Yes.
And, of course, it doesn't help that France is one of the victorious powers, and why would France give up one of its colonies?
Right, right.
This is, of course, Germany should give up its colonies, but not France.
Yes, yes, exactly. we know how that works, right? The old hypocrisy that's there.
Yep.
But after that, Ho becomes an increasingly hard left-leaning trajectory. He travels to the Soviet Union, becomes part of the Comintern, how to grow a Marxist movement, right, agitprop and all that stuff, spends some time in China. And then he comes back to Vietnam in World War II. So he's gone for 30 years, doesn't come back till 1941. But even there, right, not much is going on. Minor guerrilla warfare stuff going on. As we know, the United States and the OSS gets involved because of its war against Japan in 1945. But up until that point, right, Ho Chi Minh and the Vietnamese communists and the front group they put together, the Viet Minh, which was an effort to combat the French, right, and the Japanese occupiers. And that was a combination. It was not just Marxists, right? It was the whole strata of peasants and workers, this kind of front organization, people who were unsatisfied with the status quo, who wanted Vietnamese independence, wanted an end to French colonialism, are part of this Viet Minh front. But the Viet Minh is only one of many other nationalist groups at the time. However, World War II comes in, and the Japanese occupation fundamentally changes things. As we know, they come in, they occupy Indochina, they take control away from the French. They allow them, however, to administer their own colony, Vichy France, on a day-to-day basis. But in 1945, as Japan is losing the war, and it's pretty obviously that the Allies are pushing, in particular the United States, on the Japanese home islands, they decide now to do away with that. They lock up the French. They create something called the Empire of Vietnam. They bring back the last Vietnamese emperor, Bao Dai, and put it as head. They're defeated in World War II, and then there's essentially a power vacuum. And into this power vacuum, Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh are able to step into the vacuum and declare Vietnam independent in 1945.
Okay, so we're at 1945. So Ho Chi Minh has had all of this broadening education in the greater communist ideas. When do we actually see Dao Tron start to become articulated as such?
It's really later on, because initially the early writers, once After 1945, as we know, Ho Chi Minh declares the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, Vietnamese independence, and the French say, not so fast, we are going to reassert our control over our former colony. And this is what sparks what will become an eight-year war of the Franco-Vietnam War, the first Indochina War, in which the Viet Minh are now fighting against the French. And their Vietnamese allies to get the French out of Indochina. And it's really there when they start to articulate this kind of Dao Tron strategy. And the thing is, they never called it themselves Dao Tron. It's really in their writings. But the thing is, the early tracks, when you talk about Truong Chinh and Noven Giap, in their early treaties, they're really following that Maoist blueprint. They're talking about a vanguard party. They're talking about hybrid war, guerrillas and conventional. They talk about those three stages. They talk about the peasants are going to be the fist that we're going to use to achieve the revolution, the kind of their military and political power for this. But it's later on they start modifying some of those practices as well, too. Now, again, they never really articulate, they never call it Dao Tron themselves. That's something that Douglas Pike, a Vietnamese communist expert during the war, had branded it.
This is the blitzkrieg of the Vietnam era, of the Vietnam War.
Yeah, but they make some modifications, and that first modification is something that was this Dao Tron strategy. And Dao Tron essentially is a synthesis of political action, what they called it, and political Dao Tron or political struggle and armed struggle. Now, armed struggle was just essentially violence, be it localized violence such as kidnapping, assassination, intimidation, just propaganda with guns, guys walking around with weapons, right? That's one way to get people to do what you want them to do. Or outright kind of, small-scale guerrilla warfare or even conventional warfare. Any kind of bloodletting or actual violent actions was armed Dao Tron. Political Dao Tron was non-violent stuff, and it was mostly propaganda and information operations. And the two were really meant to work together. Now, if armed Dao Tron was guerrilla warfare, conventional warfare, terrorism, political Dao Tron had three different programs in this propaganda and operations. They called them action programs. The first one was known as Dan Van, and that was action among the people. Now, in areas that were occupied, they called them liberated zones by the insurgency, right? They would go out and just do their typical stuff. They would propagandize the population. They would indoctrinate them. They would get fighters. They would get resources so they can fight. But they were operating in areas among the people, mostly information operations and propaganda, in areas that were under communist control. That was the action among the people. Their second one was Ditch Van. That was another program, and that was action among the enemy. That was meaning the South Vietnamese civil administration or those South Vietnamese civilians who were living in areas controlled by the South Vietnamese government. Same thing, it's not violent in nature, it's just information, operations, propaganda to try to convince those people that the Saigon regime is bad, they're no good, maybe you should join our side or help us and don't help them. And then the third one they had was called Bin Van, and that was action among enemy soldiers. And that was same thing, propaganda, information operations to try to convince political cadre or soldiers in the South Vietnamese government to defect to their side. And that was their kind of three programs inside of South Vietnam as part of political Dao Tron. Now, another element to that, some historians in recent years, well, Douglas Pike, I mentioned him before, he put diplomatic struggle, right, another form of Dao Tron, within political Dao Tron. He put diplomatic struggle in there. Recent historians, particularly Pierre Azeline and others, have put political struggle as a distinct branch unto itself. You had armed struggle, political struggle, and diplomatic struggle. And what diplomatic struggle was, same thing, it's information operations, propaganda, but it's looking internationally. If political Dao Tron was focused internally on South Vietnam, diplomatic struggle was focused externally. And that itself had three target audiences. The first, or diplomatic circles, as Hanoi called them. The first diplomatic circle was fellow socialist or communist states. Naturally, they're fellow ideological travelers. They're naturally going to recognize you and give you aid and assistance in your war. They called that proletarian internationalism. That was one of the targets or circles, one of the groups they wanted to target. And their messaging was, hey, you're Marxist, we're Marxist. Naturally, you need to help us and side with us in this conflict. The second diplomatic circle was former colonial states around the world, former colonial states that are not necessarily communist, right, but had gone through that process of oppression and exploitation by European powers. So they were saying, hey, you might not be Marxist or communist, but you know what? You went through that crappy existence as well, too. We are fighting for national independence and an end to French colonialism. You should side with us as well, too. That was another audience, and they crafted their message carefully towards that particular audience. Now, the last diplomatic circle was publics in the West, be either in Europe or the United States. And that diplomatic circle was to try to convince those people that what the South Vietnamese government and what the American government were doing was unjust. Now, the brilliance of this diplomatic strategy, and particularly that last diplomatic circle, which was the most important, is that it used kind of judo principles in the fact that most propaganda usually traditionally is black and white, right? We are virtuous, our enemies are unvirtuous. We are good, our enemies are evil, right? We are fighting a just war, they are fighting an unjust or illegal war. But the brilliance of this diplomatic struggle and the message they were giving, particularly to the United States, was that we don't hate Western values. We don't hate the United States or American values. We love and admire Americans and American values. What we do hate is your criminal government who is waging an anti-colonial war, right, to crush, right, the aspirations of the Vietnamese people on your behalf. Are you comfortable with that? So they shared virtue, hoping to gain people, you know, the support of people around the world, and particularly here in the United States, who's going to oppose the American war in Vietnam. And that's where they were most successful. They were able to isolate the United States internationally, because we had very few allies who joined us in this war to try to preserve South Vietnam, Australia, South Korea, New Zealand, Thailand. But other than that, the Brits and the French, they were very reluctant to get involved. And as we know, here in the United States, it generated a lot of fuel for the anti-war movement. And even if it didn't actually do that, it created, I think, enough unease and unrest in the minds of most Americans, or at least uncertainty and doubt about what we were doing, that political figures were very aware of public opinion, that this was the real front, right, or the center of gravity for our effort was American public opinion. That's the Achilles heel, if you will, for democratic societies, is the fact that we have elections, and those things are something that adversaries can leverage, so they were targeting that as well, too. So that was a modification to kind of the Maoist model, but so part of Doutron.
So let's take that diplomatic doctrine just for a minute. So what did that actually physically look like in the United States? Is this just them sending out communiques? TV is obviously still in its infancy. So are they like buying airtime on radio? How are they doing this?
Right. Well, I mean, just getting messages out. They have ambassadors out. They'll have, you know, they were good at creating a narrative, right, for themselves and their side. And obviously in the age of media, journalists and television people and sympathetic individuals, intellectuals, were picking up on this. And naturally, people who were opposed to war or who had an unfavorable image, right, of the United States on the world stage in the Cold War, they would just buy into this kind of stuff. Again, it's purely propaganda. There's no formal diplomatic area until 1968 with the Paris Peace Accords. But they have ambassadors and people who are around the world spreading this message.
So they have both Vietnamese communist people going to, say, the United States to talk on a college campus or wherever, and they were also bringing intellectuals to North Vietnam.
No, I don't think there was. No, there was no exchange like that, as far as my understanding. But they did have also, they had two giant megaphones on their side too, which is the Soviet Union and the Chinese, who did have formal, you know, kind of a presence on the world stage, who can parrot those kinds of things. And you had any kind of leftist governments or movements, or I should say, groups, or, you know, throughout the West, who would also echo their sentiments, who were kind of speaking on their behalf. They had no formal kind of diplomatic ties, really, until 1968 with the Paris Peace Accords.
Okay.
But they were just good at getting that message out and having allies or people at least sympathetic to them get that message out for them.
No. So I think what's striking about Doutron as compared to Marxism-Leninism, or especially Maoism, is from the way you describe it, it sounds more practical than ideological. That the Vietnamese were willing to bend or perhaps even break the model in order to win their war. Like you said, by at least in, you know, propaganda, saying they approve of Western values. Is that a correct reading of it?
Yeah, because for them, military force was not a means unto itself. And this is a problem with the United States both then and as, you know, critics today will argue that we still kind of do that. We focus, you know, there's a bifurcation, and then the talkers talk, the fighters fight, and there's no unification of action, or the idea that, you know, the West and the United States seem to forget that the idea, although it's often, you know, quoted to, you know, ad nauseum, that war is the extension of policy with other means, or extension of politics with other means. The Vietnamese communists fully understood that. So every violent act they ever took, whether it's, you know, killing a village or hamlet chief at the grassroots level, or a platform or a speech in Paris during the peace accords, they were all geared towards that political end state, and they understood that. So they truly synthesized military force and political force into a holistic effort, if you will. We call it here in this schoolhouse, as you know, all elements of national power. They understood that. They understood the power of narrative and the primacy of politics. And really, military force was just a means to get them there. And I think they really understood that. And that's kind of the beauty of Dao Tran, right? Because it not only brought down the French, it brought down the United States, and they used it against China as well, too, in 1979.
So on this ideological purity line, are these leaders, you know, Ho Chi Minh, Zop, Lê Duẩn, Lê Đức Thọ, are they all marching in lockstep? Are they all on board with how this is going, or are there debates about how to do it?
Well, there were debates on how to do this as well, too. And there was a schism that develops in the Politburo, in which you have moderates such as Ho Chi Minh and Zop on one side, and hardliners like Lê Duẩn and Lê Đức Thọ, Nguyen Chi Tan on the other side. And that was over how do we go about achieving this. Although their ends were always the same. The end state was always the end of French colonialism, the unification of Vietnam under Hanoi's banner and under a socialist government. That's where, but how are you going to go about doing this? Now for Ho Chi Minh and Zap, they wanted a more slower approach. They wanted that Maoist protracted war, three-stage, do what you can. Initially, in 1955, after you have a North and South Vietnam, they want to focus on the North exclusively. They want to rebuild, they want to build socialism in the North, as they called it. You know, resurrect their economy, which had been destroyed, right? World War II, fighting the French for so long. They wanted to, you know, resurrect their economy, collectivize agriculture, you know, kind of become, make it an industrialized modern society. And we'll worry about liberating the South and unifying the country at a later date. Lê Duẩn and the hardliners, they didn't want to hear any of that. They wanted to push hard. They wanted to liberate the South now. They want to move forward. And they said, protracted warfare, we subscribe to that. But we need, if there's an opportunity, to bypass that and go for broke and deliver a knockout blow.
Less protracted.
Yes, less protracted. And that's where the second modification to Maoism is that the Vietnamese introduce is the general offensive and general uprising strategy. And that's to pair a military offensive with popular uprisings in the city. One thing about Lê Duẩn and the hardliners in the Politburo, and this probably maybe even the moderates, there's that old adage in modern kind of pop culture, getting high in your own supply. Now, Hanoi truly believed that the overwhelming majority of the South Vietnamese hated the Saigon regime, were just chomping at the bit, looking for a ripe opportunity for themselves to take power, right, through a popular uprising, take power in their own hands by toppling the Saigon regime in those urban areas, much like they did in 1945 in that power vacuum. I mean, because that's the thing, it was really more of a coup than a revolution in August of 1945. Again, there's a power vacuum. Japanese are gone, French are gone. Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh just kind of walk into the buildings and say, yep, we have, you know, control of the organs of the state. We're now the government. So this was an effort to bypass that, and they truly believed if they could just come in and bloody either the South Vietnamese or Americans in a hard offensive, the people themselves are going to see that as an opportunity to rise up and seize power for themselves. So it was this joint tandem thing of a general uprising and a general offensive paired together. And that was, again, meant to deliver a knockout blow to bypass that three stages of or protracted warfare Maoist model.
Now, we see this, of course, most famously in the Tet 1968 offensive.
Yes.
Which, of course, does not work as well for them militarily as they would have liked.
No, none of them do, right? They try it in 64, there's no uprising. They try it in 68, there's no uprising. They try it in 72, there's no uprising.
And then they try again like 74, 75, and it kind of works?
At the end, but there is no uprising. Yeah. That's by that point, it's a conventional military operation.
It's an armored division taking Saigon.
Right, right. But when you mix these things, when you mix the Dautron strategy, the fusion of armed struggle and political struggle, when you look about those propaganda and information operations, when you look at those, the diplomatic struggle overseas, when you look at the general offensive and general uprising strategy, together these things created, right, a brand of warfare and a method that was unbeatable, right, and that helped them, you know, drive the United States out of Vietnam and eventually achieve everything they were looking to achieve.
So let's talk about how this works on the ground. Let's say we have a village somewhere in the south, far south, not, you know, up on the border. It's never really been contacted by the communists. It's under the rule of South Vietnam in whatever era. How does Dautron approach making this a pro-communist place? Again, a virgin village, no communist influence up until this point. What do they do?
Something that was known as the Viet Cong infrastructure, political cadre were always the kind of tip of the spear, right? And local forces, local militia or local guerrillas, because they would go in, and if there's no real serious government presence, they didn't have to fight, right? What they would do is just essentially try to redistribute land, right? They would propagandize the local population in an effort to try to get them to side them. And early on, I mean, there was a lot of South Vietnamese who were receptive to the message of the Viet Minh, right? Or the National Liberation Front after 1960. Now, granted, it wasn't their land to give, but still, it was something that was a carrot that they could entice the people to join them. If the carrot wouldn't work, the stick would work, right? And that's where you would find targeted assassinations. Those kinds of things are a force multiplier, right? Because it tells the people that the Saigon government, they say they're the government, but government's first job is to protect you, and they can't. We can get to you whenever we want.
Monopoly on violence.
Yes, yeah. So they'd be able to go in. So through that carrot and stick blends, right? Preferably the carrot first, but if not, you would use the stick in increasingly kind of extreme measures to try to get to what you needed, to get areas under your control. And that's really what it was. The old idea that guerrillas don't fight for territory, that's true. And the thing is, they can surrender territory, right? Trade space for time. But at the end of the day, they still need something they can point to on a map or an area to say, we control this place, or we control the people within this place, right? That we occupy. These are quote-unquote liberated areas under our control to be able to demonstrate that they are the legitimate government. Because other than that, you're like an idea that's just free-floating.
Right. But of course, right? This is, of course, I hesitate to use the word genius, but I can't think of a better one, of the Dautron approach, which is even if you have to leave with the guy, even if the guys with guns have to leave, if you've done your job properly in indoctrinating the people, you can always come back.
Right. Or just scare them with your guns, right? You can always come back as well, too.
And then, but the local government does not re-indoctrinate or counter-indoctrinate the people in that village. That becomes a overall win for you.
Well, they would try to do it. That's what pacification was all about. Yes. Side with the government because we provide a better life for you, right? Because we can provide you more tangible means to improve your lives and livelihoods, right? Mm-hmm. The communist promises are all empty. Right, they'll never fulfill what they want to do. But because you had this fusion of political and military action, right, this carrot and stick approach, Dautron led to different types of forces, right? You had just pure political cadre, right? You did have local force guerrillas, you had main force guerrillas, and you had regular conventional forces. And depending on the situation, they could apply that as needed in a carefully calibrated approach depending on local circumstances. So in places where there was a government presence or there was some degree of kind of, you know, Saigon territorial forces, whatever, they'd have to up the game a little bit with their own force backwards. And that's why some people have described this as kind of a mosaic war. Because in some places in South Vietnam, you did just have that low-level kind of political agitation, getting people to side with you, and they're claiming this area is under our control. Other places, you did have that guerrilla conflict going on, and even other places, you had that hybrid kind of conventional guerrilla stuff going on as well, too. And it was all mixed up in different areas. It was never consistent or uniform throughout the whole country.
So how centralized of a control was this? Because obviously, you've got people scattered throughout a fairly undeveloped country in many places.
Yes.
So is this Lezuan or Ho Chi Minh issuing directives and people all carrying it out, or is this very much more decentralized?
No, it's not decentralized. It's firmly controlled from Hanoi, right? One of the myths that was created and that many Americans, including historians, have bought into a very long time is that the National Liberation Front was a genuinely autonomous Southern movement. Now, early on, it was, but even then, not so much, right? Because the thing is, the National Liberation Front was left, was the genesis of it were hardcore Viet Minh fighters who had come down into the South and then did not go back up north after 1954. But the thing is, there is truth to it, that it was a united front. They were not all Viet Minh or communists. There were many other groups who just did not like the Saigon regime and joined this Viet Minh, or you know, the Viet Minh or the National Liberation Front, which were front organizations. But they never had any autonomy, whether it was through obliquely through the Central Office of South Vietnam, which was the southern organ of Hanoi that ran the insurgency, or directly from Hanoi in the northern half of South Vietnam. They were taking their orders from Hanoi. There was no self-direction from these groups. It was all dictated from Hanoi, whether through Cosvin or directly from Hanoi down, of what the strategy and what the approach will be, what your goals are, what you can do, what you cannot do.
Okay. So how unified was the North Vietnamese command structure? Okay, so yes, the structure is there. Did this people from the South press, we need more, we need less? What are the good debates going on inside of this central command structure?
Okay, well, yeah. I mean, the thing is, 1964 is really when it becomes a hybrid war. Right? You get National Liberation Front is formed in 1960. For 3 years, they're kind of doing their own thing. They get some material, obviously, from the North. They couldn't survive on their own. But the North Vietnamese don't really interject with conventional forces until about 1964. But once they do, they're always there, but they're not really operating in the lowlands where the population centers, which were along the coast and in the Mekong Delta and in the central highlands in certain portions as well, too, because they couldn't operate there, right? That'd be a big fat target for them, right? They were usually trying to set up their base areas in remote areas. It was largely a National Liberation Front fight, right, with trying to influence the local population until after Tet. Right. After 1968, the National Liberation Front and their fighters, the People's Liberation Armed Forces, are so devastated that the only way they're able to sustain themselves from 68 to the end of the war is by having North Vietnamese Army service fillers.
The NLF is essentially exterminated at Tet, right?
Pretty much. Not completely. It's still there. They hang on. A hardcore, you know, center survives, and their infrastructure survives, which is important. But the only thing that allows them to survive is this infusion of North Vietnamese Army regulars who break down into smaller units to kind of replenish those depleted units. They also take a step back, right? The idea that the war was, you know, very quiet in 1970 because we were doing everything right, meaning the South Vietnamese and the United States, this better war thesis, is only partially correct. The other thing is that the Lê Duẩn, after the disaster of Tet, he's really chastened and says, you know what, we do need to take a step back. We're going to revert back to protracted warfare again, just to try to stretch out and exhaust the South Vietnamese and the Americans. Because for them, that's the center of gravity, right? Just live to fight another day. This is the war of the flea.
Yeah.
You stretch out and exhaust your enemy over time, they're eventually going to quit. So for Hanoi, this Dao Tran and general offensive and general uprising was always geared towards breaking, psychologically exhausting the United States, breaking its political will so they give up the fight and then they could focus alone on the South Vietnamese, which is exactly what happened through this Dao Tran strategy, this modification of Maoism, and the introduction of general offensive and general uprising. So together, that kind of melange, if you will, of all these different approaches, these different types of forces, this diplomatic effort overseas, they do hang on, they're tenacious, and they achieve in the end what they were looking to achieve.
So one of the things we always ask about theory when we look at the influence of theory is, are these ideas, as you mentioned, Douglas Pike actually coined the term for this approach. Are these ideas that we have kind of backdated into history and said, oh, this is what they were doing? Or are these ideas, you know, other than the name Dao Tran, are these ideas that they talked about at the time and said, this is what we are doing?
They talked about it all the time. Almost every directive or speech that you heard when they were discussing the war, what they're trying to do, it was always this marriage between political struggle and military struggle. They talked about it constantly and the need to unify. They never lost sight of that. Mm-hmm. So for them, it was, again, I believe what they truly understood the nature of war as Clausewitz did, right? That it is politics with other means, and that's it, and you can't divorce the two. Mm-hmm. Right? That battle and talking are not two separate spheres of activity. They should be done simultaneously to affect one another. So they understood that, and that's what Dautron was all about. And they knew it, and they talked about it. Not Dautron, but political struggle, armed struggle. Yeah.
So, and there's a coda to all of this. This was really interesting. You know, in America, we tend to focus on the as I said, the 64 through 75 period. But communists end up fighting each other at the end of that decade.
Yes.
When you have the Sino-Vietnamese War, when the Chinese invade Vietnam and the Vietnamese are right back to an imperial power that is in their country.
Yes.
So what happens in that war? How does Dautron fare when they're facing a fellow Maoist force?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, and I'm not sure exactly how it, you know, it played out. I mean, part of it was that they used this idea of that they were able to paint China as almost like a neo-imperialist aggressor once again, right? That here they are invading our country, right? So they're able to use that kind of dialogue as well, too, as they did, you know, going after Pol Pot and what he's doing as well. But again, it's not in revolutionary kind of terms, but it was discussed in that there's these two different types of struggles that are going on that we have to do. We have to appeal to an international audience, right? We have to have a narrative and a message that we're delivering while we're fighting at the same time as well. Because China only goes in for a very short time and they leave.
Right.
So I think there's diplomatic, because remember, China, and one of the things that, you know, why they kind of fall out of favor with Hanoi at that point is that they, you know, after 72, there's a period of detente with the West.
Right.
Right. And Lê Duẩn and the hardliners, they're still in control in Hanoi, right? Lê Duẩn lives until 1986. So they're like, we're not doing this, right? So they're able to kind of use that as like, now the Chinese are betraying the revolution, right? And the Soviets are helping us, the true revolutionaries.
So as we're putting all this together, so we have Dautron. I guess it's almost an American term or an English term applied to Vietnamese, right. Using Vietnamese words.
Yeah.
But on that note, though, so is what is the significance of understanding Dautron? Is this just something that is useful for only understanding the Vietnam War? Why is it so important that that a student of history and perhaps a military professional truly understand what is Dautron?
Okay. I think for the military professional to understand is that for their influence for advising our political class or the civilian policymakers or even military policymakers, right? Those who rise above the tactical and operational levels when it comes to the strategic level is that they need to understand is that Douglas Pike argued that this is an unbeatable strategy for which there is no counter strategy. And I think he's right because it not only carried through, right, the end of the 70s and the 80s and other things, but I think that people such as the Taliban and other groups around, even I would say Hamas, understand this marriage of violence and politics in a way that the West does not understand. And that we have to, I think, what policymakers and practitioners in the West have to understand is that you do need this synthesis of action, right? That you can't just prefer to fight and be really good at fighting and then absolutely stink at explaining your cause or being able to use the tactical and operational excellence to achieve what you're trying to achieve because you need those other elements. We know the economic aspect's not really a thing because we're still wealthy and have resources beyond imagination for fighting our adversaries. But it's really, I think, that political backbone, right, and that diplomatic backbone that we simply lack in the West, that we did not make the case, I think, either in Iraq or against the Taliban. I mean, one thing I argue, I say even in Vietnam, it's one thing to argue and say that young Americans who were uncomfortable with the war in Vietnam, or Americans who were uncomfortable with the war in Vietnam in the 1960s, speaking out against what they felt was an unjust war by their government is perfectly legitimate and I think was worthy of consideration. Them, however, repeating communist propaganda and outright rooting against their own nation, right, viewing its own nation and its values as the bad guys and somehow what Ho Chi Minh and Lê Duẩn and Mao and Lenin and Marx were talking about as the good guys, I think that's a serious problem in the West of not being able to leverage those other elements of national power or even stand up for your own values.
Taking for granted that the fact that your rightness and justness are self-evident and therefore do not need to be portrayed more?
Well, I just don't think we sell it very much. Now, I understand in pluralistic societies, you're always going to have dissent, and that's the nature of the being, different perspectives on things. But when you have so many people just buying into what is obviously, right, your own self-destruction, I don't understand that, or the destruction of your own society. And I saw similar things the strategic withdrawal from Afghanistan, which was it's an ignominious retreat from Afghanistan, which was a disaster on the strategic level. When I started reading Western reporters saying, "Well, you know, this isn't really a bad thing, and we shouldn't really fear the Taliban coming to power, resuming power in Afghanistan," I said, "You know what? This is a problem, and this is what I think the issue is. We're never going to achieve our strategic aims if we can't translate our operational and tactical excellence, right, into some kind of long-term strategic gain using information and diplomacy and the other things to convince the American people this is a fight you got to stick with, that we are on the right side of this conflict and we're going to have to see this thing through, and that this is going to be a long kind of conflict. We don't do that stuff. I feel the policymaking class are lazy.
They're
risk averse, and I think it's problematic. Again, this is not the views of the United States Army or or the Command and General Staff College. This is just my own my interpretation of this. However, I think we still have a first-rate military, and the fact that we keep losing wars and not achieving our strategic aims, I think you have to look elsewhere aside from the warfighting aspect.
It sounds like what you're saying is we read Clausewitz, but we don't necessarily practice that.
Yes, absolutely. And I think we just have to understand that and gear our military excellence towards those that kind of strategic, long-term strategic gains or goals by doing the heavy lifting in those other areas. And maybe having our political class and others put their careers or put their whatever, their next election at risk to do the right thing. And I think if we don't do that, right, all our military excellence is going to be wasted time and time again. And I think Doutron, they understood that in a way. You unify where we do not.
All right, very good. It's been a fascinating conversation. Dr. Clemes, thank you.
Yep, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.